Welcome to the Thrive with Holistic Healing Co. podcast. I am your host, Namita Mahanama. Here, I bring you the synergistic utilization of Western and Eastern modalities to help you thrive in your wellness, to thrive in your mental health, to thrive in life, so that you can feel and be your best self in body, mind, and soul. Thank you for joining me. So, let's jump in together and thrive. So, hello and welcome to episode 31 of the Thrive with Holistic Healing Co. podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. Now, today's episode is going to be about alcohol and the perinatal period. Now, I wanted to cover this topic because I feel like there are so many questions, there are so many layers, there are so many points about alcohol when it comes to our health from an Eastern perspective and a Western perspective. And I really wanted to go into it and peel and unveil all of the different things and aspects that I feel are important when it comes to alcohol. Now, I guess what's obvious is that alcohol is very much a socially accepted and culturally accepted, I'll call it a drug, but it's essentially been around since 7000 BC in China. And we have been using alcohol as a form of celebration, connection with family and friends. And it really is a tool or a crutch that definitely is socially accepted in terms of using it and it being something that is socially accepted and one that probably will be around for quite some time as well. Now, in terms of some quick statistics from Australia to really understand how prevalent its use is and how common it is, in 2016, Australians spent $666 billion on general living costs. Now, of that, $14.9 billion was on alcohol. Now, if we compare this to $1.6 billion on tea and coffee, so that is a huge contrast. So 14.9 versus 1.6 billion, it's a huge difference that we spend on alcohol. Now, the Australian Bureau of Statistics data, which was released on the 21st of March in 2022, found that one in four Australians aged 18 and over exceeded the Australian alcohol guidelines in 2020 to 2021. They found that men were more likely to exceed the guidelines than women, so 33.6% versus 18.5%. Now, this is just more out of interest and if you like statistics and data. And those living in inner and outer regional and remote areas were more likely to exceed the alcohol guidelines than those living in major cities. And the reasons for that are multitude and complex. And that's not the purpose of this episode, is to go into the why of that. But that's a very interesting statistic as well. So in terms of what we're going through today. So the effects of alcohol, how it works. So including the biochemistry, short-term, long-term, long-term effects, and what an alcohol emergency looks like. What are the NHMRC alcohol guidelines? So the National Health and Medical Research Council guidelines. What is a standard drink? The relationship between sleep and alcohol. Medication safety and interactions. Now, as a pharmacist, medication safety and drug interactions are hugely important topics with alcohol. And it's actually a real trigger point for me when I see and hear people combining things that I know they shouldn't. It's not for their best interest. And so that's something that really irks me to no end. Pregnancy and alcohol, breastfeeding and alcohol, motherhood, parenthood and alcohol. From an Ayurvedic perspective, looking into armor, so the physical and emotional armor, what that means, and then what to do if you're concerned with your drinking or a loved one, where can you go, what can you do, what are some options? So those are basically what I really wanted to go through today. Now, I've spoken about this in several episodes before in terms of my relationship with alcohol, and it is definitely telling me that it's exceptionally inflammatory in nature for my body. So my body becomes exceptionally inflamed and swollen. My fingers become thicker, my feet, my legs, basically the next day, or even, you know, even quite quickly after I start drinking, I can feel the heaviness in my fingers. They start getting swollen. My face looks more swollen. My tonsils always become inflamed. Now, it can take a good 5 to 7 days to come back to normal from drinking. So for all the inflammation to reduce and the fluid to settle and subside. Now, for me, if a patient came in and told me this, then my advice to them would be, well, try to reduce your intake of alcohol, find other alternatives so that you can actually reduce your frequency and the amount that you drink. That would be my go-to advice. It definitely does provide some relaxation for me. And so I use it as a tool basically at the end of a long week to just relax. So some very basic research has indicated that red wine, vodka and gin may be the least inflammatory of them all. I haven't worked out exactly what is the right prescription or the amount that is, you know, suitable for me. But it is interesting because me, even as a health professional and someone that is in health and wellness, that the relationship with alcohol is a very interesting one. And so all the questions that I go through, they're topics of interest to me as well. Now, the other reason why I'm launching into this alcohol topic in regards to mental health and the mental health space is because it is quite complex and it's a very intricate balance between really understanding what the biochemical impacts are of alcohol on our system. And there are huge amounts of biochemistry changes that happen when we drink alcohol. And it's really about thinking of all the safety considerations with alcohol and what you should be considering when drinking alcohol. So let's just dive right in. So going into number one, the effects of alcohol. How does it work? Biochemistry, short-term, long-term effects, and what an alcohol emergency looks like. So alcohol by nature is a central nervous system depressant chemical. So it works by actually slowing down the processes in your brain and your central nervous system. And by doing so, it can reduce your inhibitions, which often is why people use it, perhaps if they're naturally shy or not enjoying social situations, that by reducing your inhibitions, it might make you supposedly feel more confident or more relaxed. Now, the cycle, though, is that your body can get used to this, meaning that your drinking alcohol, your seemingly or perceived level of relaxation increases. But what happens is our body actually goes into a fight or flight mode once the alcohol is withdrawn or leaves our system. And so what happens is once the alcohol leaves, you're entering this fight or flight, you're feeling a bit more wired and on edge. So you, for the drink, you go for alcohol, then you feel nice and relaxed. And then it's like this cycle of a roller coaster almost. You're going up and down, up and down, up and down. And so we're going to go into this further, but when it's affecting your sleep, then you're going to be reaching perhaps more for caffeine to get you through the day, which is going to heighten your nervous system even more. This fight or flight, adrenal, cortisol system is going to be on fire. You then need more alcohol to relax. And then there's questions of tolerance and needing more to have the same effect. And so this is why it's a very complex beast, so to speak. Now, in terms of mental health, the drinkaware.co.uk website, which I'll link in the show notes, makes this statement. And I really think that this is, you know, a very clear-cut statement about mental health. And it says, if you drink more than the UK Chief Medical Officer's low-risk drinking guidelines, it can have a negative effect on your brain chemistry and lead to worse mental health. Now, it also goes on to say that binge drinking is considered in the UK to be more than 8 units of alcohol in a single session for men or 6 units for women. And it states that binge drinking is found more likely to have symptoms of depression with people who have reported regular hangovers at most at risk. So that's very interesting. And it also continues to state that by cutting out alcohol completely for just 4 weeks, that it makes a clear difference in how the participants feel in terms of their mental health. So I think that's absolutely phenomenal. And so definitely I'll link that website in the show notes, those statements, that data is irrefutable. So how alcohol is a CNS depressant is so that a small amount of alcohol, it stimulates GABA, which is the inhibitory neurotransmitter. And this causes us to relax. We feel relaxed. But when we drink heavily, it actually depletes this GABA, so the inhibitory neurotransmitter. And so what that causes then is an increased in tension and feelings of panic. So often people who have an underlying anxiety disorder or anxiety condition, they may be tended to have more panic attacks and more anxiety in social situations or whatever situation that their anxiety is triggered in. Alcohol impacts other neurotransmitter systems, so glutamate, glycine, acetylcholine, and serotonin. Now, serotonin we know has different functions, mood, digestion, wound healing as some very basic examples. And so alcohol is actually impairing or interfering with serotonin. So wound healing, if you're a diabetic and there's poor circulation and you're already at risk for neuropathy and, you know, actual wound healing and ulcers, elderly people, if you think that their livers and kidneys are, as they're aging, their organ systems change, we're adding alcohol that impacts wound healing as well, then that's going to be a factor. Definitely with mood, it is going to be a factor. And all of those little neurotransmitters and hormones and chemicals, they all play a role in the functioning of so many different biochemical systems within our body. Now, alcohol, the pleasurable effects occur due to the increased level of dopamine and endogenous opioids in the reward pathway of the brain. So that is really where alcohol can now contribute to this reinforcement related adverse effect. So addiction, dependence, withdrawal. It's affecting our dopamine. We're getting that dopamine fix by consuming the alcohol. There's issues of addiction where we require it to have a baseline functioning level. There's an issue of tolerance where you need more to have the same impact as it leaves in your body, and it's an ongoing cycle. So that is very important to consider. So how much alcohol impacts your particular body is very individualized, and it will depend upon, well, how much are you drinking? What's your pattern of drinking? The quality of the alcohol that you're drinking, the body size and the composition, your age, your drinking experience, genetics, nutritional status, your metabolism, and social factors. So they're all reasons why each of us respond differently to alcohol. So there's no, as usual, no one size fits all approach, but when we understand your unique situation, all of those variables and factors, we can understand how alcohol can impact you. So what are the short-term effects of alcohol? So lowered inhibitions. So that can lead towards perhaps greater risk-taking behavior, perceived greater confidence. It might enable you to feel more relaxed and able to participate in a social situation, feeling of relaxation. It's an inducer of sleep. So it's a sleep inducer because it causes drowsiness and sedation, but it actually impacts the quality and the duration of our sleep cycle. Short-term effects, it can actually cause interpersonal conflict, greater risk of falls and accidents, altered behavior, so risky, violent behavior, hangovers, and alcohol poisoning. Alcohol also triggers a number of reactions in our body in a physical sense. So frequent urination, it's a diuretic. It can cause us to go to the bathroom very often. It has a very high inflammatory response from our immune system. It's perceived as something foreign. And so when I'm speaking of my inflammation, my body is definitely registering alcohol as a foreign unit, as a foreign object or toxin. And so it's producing an inflammatory response. Alcohol can cause an irritation to the stomach lining, and it does this by increasing gastric acid secretion. So that can enhance complications if you have peptic ulcer disease or the bacteria H. pylori. And so alcohol, if it's triggering gut-related issues and heartburn and ulcers and those sorts of things, then it is going to be something that you will need to look into. Alcohol causes a drop in blood sugar, so that can lead to dizziness if it's actually really becoming low. It might also explain then why you can have certain cravings when you're drinking alcohol, because you need carbohydrates or you need a fuel that's going to rise your blood sugar levels. It can cause the expansion of blood vessels, so that flushed look on your face. Definitely alcohol can cause that. It can cause liver damage. Now, due to the accumulation of fats in your liver as a result of metabolizing alcohol, and it can actually cause cell death within the liver itself. So that is a huge detoxifying organ, and the impact of alcohol on it is very significant. Now, in terms of what are symptoms of a hangover, the symptoms usually last up to 24 hours and they resolve on their own. And it's essentially the body's into alcohol leaving your system. So as your body's metabolizing, clearing, detoxifying, it is going to have certain responses and reactions and effects within your body. So symptoms like thirst, headache, muscle aches, diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, weakness, trembling or shaking. And since we've explained all the physiological effects it can have on your body, these all make sense. A rapid heart rate, increase in blood pressure, dry mouth and eyes, poor concentration, an increased sensitivity to light and sound, feeling like the room is perhaps spinning or there's dizziness, anxiety, depression, irritability, mood disturbances, feeling jittery, poor, restless, or less sleep. So there are a lot of symptoms. So alcohol definitely has an impact on our body. And hangovers tend to be worse if we drink on an empty stomach, use other drugs, and smoke nicotine, which is known to make hangovers worse, sleep poorly after drinking, which is actually often very much so what happens, drink dark colored alcohol, so things like brandy, rum, and whiskey. Supposedly hangovers are worse with that type of alcohol. Now, what is an alcohol poisoning emergency? So this would be a situation where it is a life-threatening emergency, and it's really because so many different organ systems are involved with alcohol. So we don't know the impact that alcohol will have because it's unique based on all of those variables I mentioned before. And so you might feel like, oh, they'll recover or get better, but actually it can be very, very much life-threatening. And so to call 000 if there's any suspicion or uncertainty whether there is a poisoning situation happening. So symptoms such as confusion, vomiting, seizures, slow breathing, less than 8 breaths per minute, or an irregular breathing, so a gap of more than 10 seconds between breaths, blue tinged or a pale skin color, hypothermia, so a low body temperature, difficulty remaining conscious, passing out, unconscious, they can't be woken. So obviously the amount of alcohol to reach this point will be different for every single person. So if in doubt, please check it out, because we really don't want any more casualties to alcohol poisoning, that it can be something that an emergency department can help to really manage. So what are the long-term effects of alcohol? So those were the short-term, the long-term effects. Now, the World Health Organization actually indicates that alcohol contributes to more than 200 different types of diseases and injury types. Now, that is huge, huge amount. Some examples are road and other accidents, mental health conditions such as anxiety, depression. It can interfere with antidepressant medication, domestic and public violence, crime, family breakdown, social dysfunction, cardiovascular disease, cancers, being overweight and obesity, risk to unborn babies, liver disease, long-term cognitive impairment, and the risk of self-harm. So those are quite significant long-term impacts. And so that is always information to keep at the back of your mind as to what actually can happen. So what are withdrawal symptoms? So withdrawal is your body's into the alcohol not being in your system. when we have a tolerance, when there is this almost reliance, our neurotransmitters and biochemistry adapts to having alcohol within our system when we're drinking on a continual basis. And so withdrawal symptoms include confusion, paranoia, anxiety, insomnia, agitation, tremors, fever, nausea, vomiting, seizures, hallucination and delirium. So this is where if someone is a long-term drinker, then for them to not have alcohol within their system, they're going to exhibit these sorts of withdrawal symptoms, and that can be a difficult thing to manage at home if this is a first time round or you're not really trained or know what to do in that situation. And so it's very important that we don't go cold turkey if we are heavy long-term drinkers of alcohol, and that we do seek medical attention, medical guidance and help. And so I go into support information a little bit further on. But that is definitely something to keep in mind. Now, what are the NHMRC, the National Health and Medical Research Council guidelines? So I'm talking about here in Australia. The statement I mentioned before was from the UK, but here in Australia, what are the guidelines? So the statement on the website, the government website, which I will link on the show notes, is that the lifetime risk from drinking alcohol increases the more you drink. For healthy men and women, the guidelines are drinking no more than 10 standard drinks per week. That reduces the lifetime risk of harm from alcohol-related injury or disease. So 10 standard drinks per week. Drinking no more than 4 standard drinks on any one day. That reduces the risk of alcohol-related injury arising from that occasion of drinking. Children under 18 should not drink alcohol to reduce the risk of injury and harm to health. Women who are pregnant to prevent harm from alcohol to the unborn child. Women who are pregnant or planning to become pregnant should not drink alcohol. Women who are breastfeeding, not drinking alcohol is the safest for your baby. So those are the guidelines, the NHMRC guidelines, and I do believe that they were updated last year. So pop the link on the show notes, do check it out. What is a standard drink? So a standard drink contains 10 grams of pure alcohol. Now that's irrespective of the type of alcohol, irrespective of if it's mixed with ice, juice, water, whatever. So the volumes of different types of alcohol will change to give this 10 grams of alcohol because the strength of the alcohol will differ. There's an excellent visual representation of the different types of alcohol and the names and the volume and the strength and how much makes a standard drink on the health.gov website. So I'll link that in the show notes. I think definitely check that out. What you might think is a standard drink may be exceptionally over what you think. So just have a look. I think that's actually quite an important resource to have. Take a picture of it, perhaps as a screenshot. Keep it in your important folder on your phone if you're out and you need to check it. It's really important. You know, you don't want to be caught in terms of safety, and drink driving is a whole other topic. And I don't really cover it in this episode at all, but really safety is going to be exceptionally important. And the standard drinks is really to understand what impact it's going to have on your body and how you are going to be able to operate machinery. So do check that site out. I would keep that visual guide somewhere easily obtainable for you. Now, the next topic is alcohol and sleep. Now, I have found an excellent article on the Sleep Foundation website, which I'll link in the show notes as well. And the Sleep Foundation is the go-to resource for amazing medically backed, medical practitioner, urged and accredited and kind of analyzed articles. So that's actually a beautiful resource. So I would keep that on hand if there's any topics pertaining to sleep. So essentially, alcohol induces sleep. So it's a CNS, central nervous system depressant, and it makes us drowsy. It does. That's just the nature of what it does. Now, normally within our sleep cycles, we have 4 sleep cycles. So we have 3 non-REM or rapid eye movement cycles, and we have 1 rapid eye movement cycle stage, and they all last about 90 to 120 minutes. So alcohol encourages us to sleep quickly. So it induces sleep quickly, but we actually fall into the deep sleep state much quicker. And so we actually bypass the first two stages. And so it's disrupting the usual balance that we would have between slow wave sleep and REM sleep. So this essentially reduces the quality and the duration of the sleep, and it can actually increase symptoms of sleep apnea by 25%. That's a huge number. Now, sleep apnea, so it's an obstructive sleep disorder where there's almost a lack of oxygen being able to get into your system, and alcohol is very much able to increase the symptoms. So snoring, waking up, you can often hear people, you know, it sounds like they're trying to gasp for air. And so sleep apnea is something that I would always recommend if there's any concern about that, to chat to your GP and your pharmacist. There's often CPAP machines and other tools that can be given to help you if you have sleep apnea. Conducting sleep study tests will also be very, very important as part of that. But that's a whole separate topic as well. So specifically to alcohol, because it is disrupting your normal sleep cycle, you're going to feel tired the next day. So I've already explained that it reduces the quality and the duration of your sleep. So the next day you're going to feel tired. So then you will lean on stimulants. So I've mentioned this before. So you'll have caffeine or guarana or whatever it is your go-to stimulant. And so that's going to thereby impact sleep as well, because your central nervous system is on, it's heightened, it's super arousal. And so then perhaps you might rely on alcohol to induce sleep again, but the quality and duration is going to be affected. And so it's this cycle, it's this roller coaster, uppers, downers, and it can't be a sustainable way for our body to be pushed into stimulation, retract back into relaxation. Our body naturally can do that on its own if we're not adding foreign or external agents into our system. So sleep is a huge pillar of health, and I've spoken about this in a number of episodes, but from a Western perspective, sleep is vital. From an Eastern perspective, sleep is a vital pillar of health. And so alcohol will affect our ability to thrive, for the very nature of it affecting our sleep just as one component. If we're thinking about sleep deprivation in a newborn baby stage of life, it may not be to that extent, but by drinking alcohol, if we're going to be repeatedly going into this stage, then I would say sleep deprivation is going to be something that's not going to help or encourage us to feel our best and to have our optimal sense of well-being and health. So medication safety and interactions. So we've understood that alcohol affects several neurotransmitters. So as well as we understand that our detoxification organs, our kidneys and our liver, need to clear the alcohol from our system. Okay, that's just what happens. Now, that's going to put a lot of stress on our body. Now, if we're thinking about adding any other medication, so whether it's over-the-counter meaning you can just get it, you know, without speaking to a pharmacist, without a prescription, even from a supermarket, but it still is medicinal. And it still has an impact on our body. Even if we're talking about herbal and natural supplements, our body, our detoxification systems need to clear it from our body. So we need to think about, well, think of the extra work and the burden that's placed on our liver and kidneys to clear them all. It's seen as foreign. It needs to work hard. It needs to detoxify it. Medications can make you drowsy as well. So if we're adding alcohol that is also making us drowsy, it's going to have an additive effect with alcohol, and it can cause sedation, but so much so that it can be fatal. And it's called respiratory depression. And it's something that absolutely can take someone's life. So I don't take it very lightly. It can definitely be something that's quite serious. Also, it might feel like the combination is innocuous and benign. Say, for example, as a sedating antihistamine. So you use it, you've used it all the time, but it really can be a very fatal combination. Even paracetamol, that is a huge trigger point for me when I hear of people, oh, I took a Panadol and they're sitting there having a beer and laughing as if it's nothing. That's a big trigger point for me, because I don't find it funny at all. In fact, I find it quite horrifying that we're putting our liver under so much stress and strain, and it's just, for me, any combination is something that we need to speak to your pharmacist about. Don't assume that it's safe or benign or innocuous, because, you know, antibiotics can have an impact. Anti-inflammatories, any over-the-counter, herbal, anything medicinal, they have an impact to interact with alcohol. They absolutely do. Now, there are also medications that you shouldn't stop suddenly. And so you might want to have a drink, or you might want to have a few drinks, and you might stop your medication thinking, oh, well, perhaps that's safer. But stopping and starting certain medication can also have fatal and very dangerous consequences. And so my advice to you would always be to seek advice from a pharmacist. That's what we're trained in. We know what the potentialities of certain combinations are, what is an absolute contraindication, what is an absolute no, don't do that. Some that, you know, look, it's not ideal, but, you know, you could. And we can definitely guide in terms of what medications you can safely perhaps miss a day. There probably isn't a lot, but generally speaking, there are some that you absolutely cannot. And so my advice to you in this instance is definitely seek advice. I also would mention in this same topic that some of the medication that's used to treat anxiety have an impact on the central nervous system. And so combining them with alcohol is going to lead towards more sedation. And what's also interesting is that alcohol, because it can impact GABA and therefore impact our anxiety symptoms, that perhaps we might think our anxiety is getting worse, taking more anxiety medication, but perhaps it's the alcohol that's exacerbating it or precipitating it or making it worse. That it's almost like observing and seeing what is the cause and effect. And sometimes it can be very hard if you've been perhaps drinking on a consistent basis, but suddenly anxiety is becoming worse. But I would always consider that alcohol can be a factor in anxiety symptoms. And so another thing when we're talking about antidepressants is that we're taking antidepressant medication, for example, which are going to try to correct biochemistry and neurotransmitters. And alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. Really, alcohol can impact the brain chemistry. And so it's going to make it harder to know, is the medication working? Is the medication potentially less efficacious than perhaps we weren't having alcohol? So until you know that there is homeostasis and this beautiful equilibrium within your body to know the impact of alcohol. And so I'm really saying, in the first instance of starting medication, I really feel like trying to not drink alcohol would always be, you know, a safer and more sensible approach. But someone with alcohol dependence, often it is recommended to deal with the alcohol dependence side and then addressing the mood related condition, because often alcohol can be the causative factor. And once we've removed that as a variable, we can really see the baseline level of how it is that you're feeling. And it becomes easier to then treat what your mood related symptoms are. So I hope that makes sense. I'm not sure that I just went around in a big circle. Now, pregnancy and alcohol. So the current guidelines stipulate that it's safest to not drink if you're planning to fall pregnant, and definitely whilst you're pregnant. So you can see that there's a lot more advertising, I'm noticing anyway. And even on alcohol, you can see the labeling with a pregnant lady and a line through it. And so it's really trying to enhance this health literacy and really this understanding of the relationship of alcohol and pregnancy. And so the advice around this is because alcohol can lead to poorer perinatal outcomes. So including low birth weight, being small for gestational age, preterm birth, miscarriage, stillbirths, birth defects, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, so FASD, and that has a huge range of adverse physical, learning, and behavioral effects after the exposure of alcohol during pregnancy. Now, women were more likely to drink alcohol in pregnancy if they lived in remote or in very remote areas. They were Indigenous, they were teenage mothers. Alcohol can also affect the fertility of men and women. So the advice of not drinking alcohol whilst you're planning to fall pregnant is there. But also, if you're planning to fall pregnant, you may not already know that you are pregnant. And so actually with my eldest son, Ari, that's exactly what happened. So we actually fell pregnant the very first time of trying. So we weren't really prepared for that. And I went out, our business partner's parents had come to visit us in Cairns, and we went out for dinner, and we had some plum wine, and I think I had two glasses of plum wine, and I must have been 2 weeks later I found out that I was pregnant, and I just felt so guilty. I carried so much guilt around that, you know, my first pregnancy, how could I have done that? And so I definitely appreciate the value of that advice. If not drinking when you're trying to conceive, then it's just really taking that variable out completely. You're not having to carry that mental load of guilt and whatever else it is that you're carrying if you do drink and you happen to fall pregnant. I'm sure it's happened many times all across the world, and you know, who knows if it did have an impact on him. I love the boy dearly, but you know, there are times when he's being really naughty that I'm like, did I do that? But anyway, no, it's his dad. His dad definitely caused all of his annoying issues anyway. So I could definitely see that advice as being relevant. Okay, so moving on to breastfeeding and alcohol. So I'm going to link the Australian Breastfeeding Association's article on the show notes, because what I'm about to read out is essentially what is on their website. And so the concentration of alcohol in breast milk follows the amount of alcohol in your blood. Alcohol will be in your breast milk 30 to 60 minutes after you start drinking. And a number of factors affect how much alcohol gets into your milk. So the strength and the amount of alcohol in your drink, what and how much you've eaten, how much you weigh, and how quickly you are drinking. So as a general rule, so this is on the Breastfeeding Association website, and if we remember that the NHMRC guidelines were that the safest thing for your baby is to not drink when you're breastfeeding, but as a general rule, it takes 2 hours for an average woman to be free from alcohol from one standard drink, and therefore 4 hours for two drinks, 6 hours for three drinks, and so on like that. So the time is taken from the start of drinking, and the FeedSafe app can help work out the times more accurately. Only time will reduce the amount of alcohol in your breasts. Pumping and dumping will not reduce the amount of alcohol in your milk, and you don't need to do this once the alcohol has passed through your system, because alcohol is not stored in your milk. So this is the exact advice that's on the Australian Breastfeeding Association website. And so the best advice is to plan ahead. So the safest option is to not drink, but if you are planning to drink, then express the milk before you start drinking so that you have essentially clean, beautiful milk there for your baby to drink. And then remember that it takes about 2 hours for one standard drink to pass through your body and therefore through your milk. So if ever you're unsure as to how much you have had to drink, if it's too soon, then there's a breastfeeding helpline that you can call on 1-800-686-268 24/7. And I'll link that again in the show notes. And you can speak to one of the breastfeeding counselors about your unique situation, and they'll go through, you know, all of the relevant questions for you. And also take a look at the FeedSafe app if that's something that you are interested in. I actually never used it personally, but certainly that's listed there as a wonderful resource. So certainly check that one out. Now, the next topic is about motherhood and parenthood and alcohol. So I can definitely understand that as parents, our days are stressful, they're full of sensory overload, there's chaos, there's movement, there's noise, mess, schedules, racing from one activity to the next, running a household, running businesses, going to work, you know, there's a lot. And even when I speak about it and lean into it, it just makes me feel really unstable. I don't know if that's the right word, but there's a lot. So I can see the natural inclination to reach for a glass of wine at the end of the day. It might feel like a beautiful reward to take the edge off. I imagine the nervous systems are being pulled in every which way. And it does make you feel relaxed because of the GABA stimulation. It can induce sleep. And so when you're feeling tired, you're feeling like, oh, it's just going to make you sleep. But, you know, our organs have to work so much harder and it affects our quality of sleep. Heavier drinking reduces GABA. So it's actually going to, in turn, affect our mood and our anxiety. And so that's why some people can actually feel more anxious and have lower mood symptoms for a few days after they've had a drink, because it can take time to stabilize or normalize. And so that's very, very important. And so what's the solution, right? We've got this vicious circle of uppers and downers. What's our solution? I can talk about it till the cows come home, but we need other alternatives, right? We can say don't drink, but okay, well, I need something to help me to take the edge off. I'm very wired and you need to be able to kind of relax. So I get that, definitely. So what are some strategies? So you can reach for a herbal tea with chamomile, lavender, lemon balm. There are also beautiful examples of calming agents in our body. The very fact that it's warm, the fact that you have to drink it slowly, it's quite a slow, mindful process and it's quite grounding. And when we're feeling frazzled and our nervous systems are stretched, feeling grounded and adding warmth and the herbs that are actually going to be calming to our nervous system are amazing things. Add some ginger in there as well. That's very grounding and warming as well. Having a magnesium salt bath. So light a candle, put some soft music, clear all the toys out of the way, out of sight. Have a beautiful magnesium bath salt. Now, a magnesium is a muscle relaxant and it can definitely be very calming for your body. You're going to feel very weightless in the bath. But certainly if you're feeling tired, keep safety in mind. If you feel like you might fall asleep in the bath, then have a support person really sort of watch out for you and check in on you. So that's just a little disclaimer there. Boiled milk. So boiled milk with ginger, turmeric, cinnamon, cloves, a splash of honey once it's cooled down a little. These spices and the sweetness, they're going to help calm the vata system. It's bringing heat. It's grounding to our nervous system. And it's, again, quite a nourishing and a rejuvenating process as well to really balance that vata system. Now, doing a warm sesame oil massage on your body. So if you can do your whole body, that's absolutely amazing. So not sesame oil that you cook with, but a cold pressed sesame oil. And so you just want to warm it ever so slightly. And so to massage your whole body. But if you can't, if time is an issue or you just don't want to do your whole body, then if you do the crown of your scalp, the backs of your back of your neck, you can do your wrists, do the soles of your feet and put socks on so you don't slip and so your bed doesn't get dirty as well. But it's really to bring in that warmth, that earth, that grounding quality to our aggravated vata system. So we just want to think of other ways to bring in relaxation and calm. And this is another one that you can do. Ideally, if you do it twice a day, in the morning as well, your nervous system will feel centered and calm. So we've spoken about exercise. Now, exercise releases endorphins. Now, I would recommend you do it through the day. If you can do it in the morning, it's really setting up our circadian rhythm. It really is giving us endogenous energy through the day. It's an outlet. All of our endorphins are going to help us feel more calm, more centered, more peaceful, more relaxed. And that is a beautiful, beautiful tool where exercise being a non-negotiable every day is going to truly benefit you. And it doesn't have to be a hard slog. You know, it could be yoga, walk, whatever it is. So instead of after dinner and you might pour yourself a glass of wine, having a bliss ball or making some bliss balls with grounding nuts and natural sweeteners, it's going to bring that grounding and the sweetness and essentially calming our nervous system and giving comfort. I think that's a real thing that we need to do when we're giving ourselves some comfort. That's very good for anxiety. And we're looking for healthier alternatives to alcohol. Now, there's actually a lot of alcohol-free brands now. When I even look through the supermarkets, I'm amazed at how many different brands there are. And so they look like alcohol. They taste like alcohol. So certainly grab some alternatives. Kombucha is another one, but it is sort of brewed from tea, so it might keep you up at night. But certainly there's so many beautiful flavored drinks if that is up your alley, or the herbal teas, or hot water is another beautiful one. Reading a book. So reading a book will really help to induce sleep. It takes your mind into another story. Journaling through your feelings, as opposed to leading towards the wine to relax. Perhaps reflecting on your day, it might be more productive, because you can actually realize, well, what are the kinks in the chain? And you can go into solution mode to be able to find what is actually bringing you stress and strain in your day, and going into solution mode. And think of the money that you're going to save as well in your budget by not spending, you know, what did I say, $14.9 billion a year versus the measly amount that we spend on tea and coffee. So that's definitely, you know, keep that as your motivation as well. So listen to some soothing music. So whatever that means to you or is for you, to meditate. Now, meditation is a beautiful tool to use at night. You could do guided meditations before you go to sleep. There are so many resources and tools that are available online that you can listen to, but certainly meditation at night is going to help really slow the mind down, and it's a relaxation tool to help you through the day. So at social gatherings, you could replace every second, third drink with a non-alcoholic beverage. So really you can get one that makes you feel like you're part of the gathering, or you can just order a non-alcoholic option, or drink so much water that you're in the bathroom all the time. You don't have time to worry about that, but essentially trying to just find what works for you. So for me, I'm very good at abstinence. I can not drink for a long, long time, but once I've had a sip, then, you know, it becomes very hard for me to say no to the next drink. And so that is often I am better just not drinking at all, because I'm going to make better choices. So it's just really looking into your habits and what's helping you can help to look to improve. And so now we go into the topic of the Ayurvedic concept of almost these undigested or unmetabolized waste products. And so they come from an emotional and a physical perspective or form. Now, from an Ayurvedic perspective, the energy of alcohol, or the virya, it's actually quite heating. And so in an episode that's soon to come about anger management and strategies to help with anger, understanding that alcohol increases the pitta, the fire aspect within our system, that there can be an increase in anger and violence when we're drinking alcohol because of the heating aspect. And it also is affecting the quality or the guna of the mind. It makes the mind more rajasic, which is more agitated and, you know, reactive, versus calm and serene and poised in the sattvic state of mind. So that's where we always are trying to aspire to be through our practices, diet, lifestyle. So I guess understanding that alcohol definitely can affect the quality of the mind, it can also create more heat within our body. So if you're finding you're getting angered more quickly, it can be the alcohol. If you're bursting, you're feeling like you're bubbling more, there's more inflammation in your body, it's increasing that pitta or that fire aspect within your system. Now, in terms of emotional armor, well, I would say that if you are going to drink, so if with every mouthful you are sitting there, side of guilt and a side of shame, oh, I shouldn't be having this, well, you're adding emotional armor, and that can be just as toxic, if not more toxic, than the alcohol itself. So if you're going to drink, drink in the spirit of celebration, of joy, of connection, of fun, and don't bring in those extra elements of other emotional toxins, because that is going to be harmful to your system. So that is very, very important. So what do you do if you are concerned with your own drinking or the drinking of a loved one? So I think we really need to understand that alcohol does create tolerance, and so alcohol dependence actually has an impact on our biopsychosocial plane. And so if there is a problem, it can be very easy to think that you can go cold turkey, I'm just going to stop, but there can be certain withdrawal symptoms, there can be symptoms that may be very hard to manage if you're doing it on your own. So I would always recommend that you go to your GP, your general practitioner is, for me, I almost see it as like a triage service. They're able to refer you to wherever it is that you need to go. They look at you, they're trained medical professions, and they can decide where it is that you need to go. Now, that absolutely could be to a psychologist, to counseling, to support networks, could be online support networks, but whatever they feel is suitable for you. They can certainly give medication to help the weaning process, the actual addiction process that exists with alcohol. Now, there's a number of lines and foundations that I will link in the show notes. So the Alcohol and Drug Foundation, Direct Line, ADIS, which is the Alcohol, Drug and Information Services. There's Alcoholics Anonymous, Beyond Blue, Lifeline, Parent Line, Family Drug Support Australia. Lots of different support networks. But my first point of call for you would be to see your GP, access any of the 24/7 support lines if you need to speak to someone desperately. And I think to keep in mind that it's a complex situation and it's not a quick fix, but that help is available. Understanding the relationship between alcohol and mood, if we look after the alcohol first, then we're better able and equipped to be able to then deal with mood-related disorders. Often at times by removing the alcohol, and that isn't going to be, like I just said, a quick fix. It may be a very painful, painstaking process, and it is part of the parcel. That's okay. But once that variable has been removed, people may find that their panic disorders, their insomnia, their anxiety, their depression symptoms lift and resolve because they're able to sleep better. The alcohol isn't affecting their biochemistry as much, that they feel better. And so, yeah, I feel like it is interconnected, absolutely. And so not to ignore that as a piece of puzzle. Yes, it's socially acceptable, but really looking into the fact that it can be a real trigger for a lot of symptoms that we have. So my mindful moment for this week for you is to really ask yourself some questions, because I do believe that the mental and physical relationship with alcohol are undeniable. So I want you to look into, how much are you drinking? How much? So how many days a week? How much in terms of volume and quantity? Why are you drinking? So what's your why for drinking? Is it relaxation, socializing? You do it in a work situation. Like, why? So what, perhaps, if you're doing it on a regular basis, if you're using it to numb a particular feeling, emotion, whatever it is, what is it that perhaps are you numbing or trying to escape from or dull or dilute or not feel as intensely? What effect is it having on your body? So how do you feel? What's happening to your mood, your physical health? So what's alcohol doing to you? What impact are you finding that alcohol has on your sleep? What impact is it having on your relationships? So there are all some things to ponder into, to reflect, and not any space of judgment, but more really looking into the why. And if it is, you know, popping up something that you feel needs to be looked into deeper, then dig deeper through journaling, meditation. If certainly you feel like that it's impacting your relationships and your health, and you can feel like you are relying on it to help with anxiety or your mood or being able to fall asleep, then please see your doctor and know that it's a kink in the chain, that once we can iron that out, that you may well feel so much better, and it will enable you to thrive and to have a healthy, beautiful, lovely relationship with alcohol, where, you know, you can still celebrate with your friends and family, but to understand the impact that it's having on your system and to make choices accordingly. So anyway, I hope you've taken some beautiful pearls of wisdom from this episode, and I thank you so much for joining me. And until next time, I hope you have an amazing, amazing week. Thank you so much for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this podcast, it would be so amazing if you could leave a review, subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a thing, share this resource and my Holistic Healing Co. website, where you will find all of the episodes and show notes, as well as share my social media to your friends and to all those who would benefit from its content. I hope you have received a beautiful takeaway to help you thrive, and I look so forward to joining you again next week.